Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hi, welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. I'm your host, the Patriarch, Alan Long, and...
I'm the host, Hannah Long, with the Progeny.
This is the home of the Permanent Spoiler.
Our final host is Professor Lewis from Oxford.
And this is our fourth episode.
It is.
Amazing.
Just about a month, and so far
we're doing the syndication.
We've only got two out of those on time, but we're working on that.
Yep. Those have been fun.
Yeah, they've been fun. This week, given the recent death of P.D. James, we wanted to focus on an adaptation of one of her books. But before we get into that, I'd like to talk about her for a while. She was one of my favorite authors, and anybody that knows me for more than about 5 minutes will know that I'm kind of obsessed with the British detective genre. She was pretty much the reigning queen of crime after, if Agatha Christie was kind of in the 40s and 50s, Dorothy Sayers in the 60s maybe, then P.D. James has been queen of crime ever since. She's best known for her series about Inspector Dalgleish, Adam Dalgleish, who's a poet detective and who features in several novels, many of which tend to kind of have some really interesting philosophical and theological thoughts on evil and justice and all that sort of thing. My favorite, and she's also quite well known for a novel from 92 called The Children of Men. Now, my particular favorite of her novels is probably Innocent Blood. I just finished that one a few months ago, actually. Baroness James was 94. Her last book came out a few years ago, which I think is just great. If I'm still writing when I'm 90, I will die happy.
If I'm still writing when you're 90, I'll be happy. I'll be happier. I would be archaic.
You would be archaeological.
I would be archaeological. Bury me in a desert in 1,000 years, I might be worth something.
She quit school when she was 16, and she lived through World War II and ended up having to work to support her family when her husband was put into a mental institution after the war, I think for shell shock, possibly, PTSD. And she had to support the family for many years until she finally became a novelist and then a very successful novelist, and ultimately ended up becoming a conservative peeress in the House of Lords, where she was quite vocal, even up into her 80s. And in her 90s, she edited part of, I think, a BBC program, and gave one of the editors a good chewing out about the size of their salaries. And that was, I think, when she was 90, which I just think is awesome. So she was a very literate person. People you hear on radio programs anymore don't really sound like they... Well, speaking of which, this podcast, you know. But she was somebody who was always very put together. Just a pleasure to listen to her talk, to read her work. Do you have anything to add to that, or?
No, I mean, I've read a couple of her books, but it's been a long time. And then I remember listening to the Mars Hill Radio Journal years ago when they talked about her and kind of some of the themes that she'd bring into her books, which was really interesting, and that's why I started reading her. But I haven't picked up a book in a long time from her.
Yeah, I highly recommend that interview. There was a very early on in that program, they actually interviewed her. There's a free version, it's an abridged version of part of that interview on the internet, which is Audition by Ken Hill? I can't remember what his name is now. Anyway, it's from the same people as Mars Hill.
No, it's not. It's Mars Hill Audio.
Mars Hill Audio. Yes.
So this came out years and years before the Mars Hill Church ever.
Yes. We're not talking like Rob Bell.
No.
So.
Or Jingle Bell.
Or Jingle Bell. or the Liberty Bell.
Or the Liberty Bell.
So, yeah. But anyway, we're going to be talking about The Children of Men,
which I have not read.
You have not read. And I wanted to do this one before you read the book because I wanted you to have an unbiased opinion about it, because I am inescapably biased about the movie because I liked the book so much. So I wanted to have a bit of a fresh opinion on that.
So I'm setting the movie up this week. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Do I do that now? Well, or are we going to talk about our comments?
Yep, from the book. We've got two comments.
Oh.
I think there might be a few I've missed.
Probably hundreds.
Yeah, you know, the blog tends to eat comments, so I'm sure that our many, many fans have left just dozens and dozens of Okay, well, I wanted to start out with a comment on our Raiders of the Lost Ark episode from Yankee Gospel Girl. And she was talking about our comparison of Raiders and Chariots, because she said she had a debate the other day with a friend who said Raiders was the greatest movie ever made in his opinion, and I was saying no, it was Chariots. He hadn't seen Chariots, but my mother and I were both piling on him a bit for saying it was Raiders. I explained that one might say Raiders was the most entertaining movie, though I don't know if it would grab my number one spot in that category either, but that in order to be counted among greatest ever films, it has to really transcend. Unless you're not going to appear silly hanging around Fiddler on the Roof, Casablanca, Chariots, On the Waterfront, etc., you're not really into the greatest films of all time. Maybe you're one of the most fun, but that's different. So, she thinks that it's not a great film, but it's an entertaining film. And...
Well, she's a girl. I mean, that's why...
That's true.
And that's why he thought it was the best movie of all time, because he's a guy.
Well, there you go, folks.
There you have it.
That's, I mean... That explains life. Well,
I mean,
I
mean, would you see women lining up around the corner to see Dirty Harry? No. And you see guys lining up around the corner to see Bridges of Madison County or whatever, you know, similar stuff. And, you know.
Okay, well, I think, you know, just to go ahead and ruin your stereotype there, that Raiders of the Lost Ark is a great movie.
I didn't say it wasn't bad.
I think that, I think we got it kind of a little bit mixed up. I said, you asked me the question, which of them should have gotten the Oscar. What I meant to say was that if it had come down to a best picture between the two, I would have said that Raiders was the better movie. Chariots had the better music. As a movie, Chariots is a little bit uneven. It kind of drags at times. It's the flashbacks, I think they're kind of cheesy. Well, I mean, not the flashbacks, the voiceovers. So it's a little bit more uneven. It's a little bit more dated. Raiders of the Lost Ark is something.
Yeah, but
it just it.
But it's almost apples and oranges.
It is. It is in a way, but Raiders, I think, is just such a fine example of its genre. It's pretty much the best of its genre. So, around here we do rate things in genre. So, that's kind of how that works. I also am not a huge fan of the whole idea that for a movie to actually be a great movie, it has to be about something really serious, or not be a comedy or something. I don't know. I mean, I think that...
Pee-wee's Big Adventure, what's that?
Exactly. There you go. That just goes and disproves it all. Mr. Bean's Holiday.
Mr. Bean's Holiday. Yeah.
Waking Ned Divine. Okay.
Yeah, you've got to be careful.
Well, we better be careful. We can't
categorize. Part of the canon.
It is. That's a great movie. Okay. Well, to move on to our next comment, that's from JCS DuPont. DuPont. I suspect that's Mr. John Seelock. And if it's not, let us know. He was talking about our Godfather Part 2 episode, and he had some really good things to say about the senator, the reason that subplot existed, and several things. He also pointed out that we do see that he highlighted your point, Patriarch, about Vito helping his community in various ways, but we never see Michael do this, and that the father and son are very different Dons, and we do witness Vito killing two men, but both are justified more or less. Michael kills for revenge, but also to consolidate his power. As mentioned above, he'd not be in his way to be killed, just useful. Thanks for your...
We'll take that under advisement.
Yes. Okay, well, I guess we can go on to the movie now.
What movie?
He likes to do that.
The Children of Men.
Children of Men.
They dropped the article.
This movie and the book share pretty much nothing but the premise. And I will let you go ahead and summarize that premise.
Well, there's lots of people being killed. And then there's lots of harsh language as it happens. That pretty much sums it up.
Okay. Moving on.
The year is 2027.
Yes.
When was the movie made? 2003?
Six.
2006.
Yeah, it would have been made in 2005.
So it's like present day type thing almost. And then it's moving ahead to 2027. The last baby had been born in 2006 kind of thing. And it's set in England, which has become kind of a police state. And the government is cracking down lots of things. But the...
Primarily illegal immigrants.
Yes, I'll get to that. And so they're cracking down on lots of them. I mean, the police are kind of everywhere. The government's more or less everywhere. And the last baby had been born in 2006, so that there's been 18 years without any new children, which is...
And nobody knows why.
Well, they mention a flu earlier. They mention a flu in the...
Well, they do, but they were talking... When Jasper and Theo are talking about it, you know, they're trying to puzzle out what's happened, and, you know, they make the joke about the stork.
Yeah, there's no... And that's one of my comments on the movie, is a lot of the... There's not a lot of questions. You just got to accept the way it is, and that nothing can be done about it. So, okay, you know, nothing can be done about it. There's no babies for 18 years, and Theo, who's our protagonist, he's got some kind of job. It's hard to tell what he does. He's a civil servant, or he does something with the government. At any rate,
we never know what government people do.
His ex-wife is now part of a group called the Fishes, and the Fishes are an anti-government or an anarchist, maybe?
Yeah, they're kind of terrorist-ish type stuff.
And you don't know why. They just are. And you don't know what they stand for either. So, but they are, his ex-wife is played by Julianne Moore. She draws Theo, who's played by Clive Owen, into their little group in order to try to get him to obtain some passes for a young woman who, as it turns out, we find out shortly into the movie, is pregnant with the first baby that's been born in 18 years, in anywhere. So, she draws him in. Basically, she's betrayed and loses her life in the process. Theo...
His ex-wife.
Yeah, right, his ex-wife. And Theo picks up the mantle, and along with Michael Caine and... What's the lady's name with the dreadlocks?
Miriam,
but she's played by...
Pam Ferris. In a shocking piece of casting. I mean, why?
And so they pick up the banner, and they're going to try and get Key, who's the young woman who's pregnant,
out of the country.
Out of the country by hook or crook. So that's the premise of the movie. And as I said, along the way, the group that had Key in the first place, that was headed by Julianne Moore, or some kind of a anti-government group, but you don't know why, and you don't know who, and you don't know any of that. But, and everybody is really, really bent on killing everybody else.
Yep. Which they do in a spectacular fashion.
Yep. And that's pretty much the premise of it. I wanted to kind of start out by talking about demography. Now, when P.D. James wrote this book, it was 1992, and she saw a lot of trends. Well, I don't know if she so much saw the trends as just had the idea and then kind of imagined the trends, but in the book, there's a shocking amount of prescience about what a society that has a birth rate that's going down, what it looks like. And because that's pretty much what the world looks like now.
The industrialized world.
Yeah, well, a good 20 years later, the West is scraping by at what's called replacement rate, where every couple has 2.1 babies. And I think the U.S. is just below that number now.
The U.S. just dropped to its lowest level in, like, ever, if I'm not mistaken. Now, I didn't see the article that I read didn't put it in terms of replacement rate, but it did say that the birth rate in the United States was at a historic low.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. Now, and if you go farther along, you see Europe, which is kind of going to be the U.S. in about 20 years, and Europe as a whole is generally, you can have 1.3 birth rates, you know, so the population is actually being cut in half.
And Japan's is, if I'm not mistaken, Japan is actually less than one. They're starting to shrink.
Yeah, old. Japan in particular was a really good example of some of the trends that she pointed out. She in the book, there are a lot of small details in the book that you don't get in this film. Actually, there are a lot of big details in the book that you don't get in this film either. But she has people, these women who will buy pets and who will buy dolls and treat them as if they were children. And you can already see that trend a little bit here in the U.S., just people are crazy about their pets. But in Japan, they have actually made robotic babies and robotic children that can hold a conversation with someone, you know, that can hold a conversation that will coo and make sounds and all that. And it's a brave new world, but that's where Japan is going.
I think if I got on Facebook and I said, look, I'm pro-choice, and I strongly believe in a woman's right to choose, and I think that, and if you give the whole spiel and made the case that we were used to hearing, that I might get a couple dings from my buddies on the right, but not it wouldn't be a lot. I don't think there would be a whole lot of backlash. But if I got on Facebook and I said, we ought to start killing dogs as they're born, just indiscriminately, dogs and cats, I think the whole internet would, my Facebook group would come unglued. It's that bad. I mean, they are. I mean, and it's well intentioned, and I know that it's well intentioned. Because people do love their pets.
But get some perspective, people.
But love isn't, that's not the purpose of love, I don't think.
Well, I mean, it's been a fascinating semester for me because I'm in a sociology class that has a bunch of 18-year-old kids, some older people in it, but we've talked about abortion, we've talked about gay marriage. We've talked about every subject under the sun, and it's been a very interesting semester because I'm pretty much the only vocal conservative in the room. And people, you know, when abortion came up, people were just not particularly interested.
Right.
It's not an issue that I think people think about on a daily basis. I don't know. I mean, it's for instance when the teacher asked how many of us opposed it from a religious point of view, that was the basis of the ultimate basis of our opinion, I was the only one that raised my hand. And this is in the South. I mean, this is the Bible Belt. We live in the Bible Belt. So it's a...
Yeah, and that's a topic maybe for another day. But it does talk, you know, that brings up the whole idea of the preciousness of of life and of children. And this movie kind of overtly plays on that or uses it.
Yeah. It does, and I wanted to kind of focus on that a little bit later. But to kind of bring it back a little bit to the point about just the world's demography problem, when you hear about doomsday prophecies anymore, it generally has to do, and it has had to do, with overpopulation for the most part. For instance, in 1968, you had a book called The Population Bomb, which was a best-selling book, and it declared that in the 1970s, the world will undergo famines, hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death, which, of course, did not happen. But the theory still hangs around, and you hear it much more often than a problem with underpopulation, particularly in the West. For instance, my biology teacher still says that the world is overpopulated and that's a huge issue, and like the imminent Professor Chicken Little, everybody's going to die, run around.
They are going to die.
Well, yes, as Professor Lewis says, the chance of your death is 100%, and it cannot be improved. Why do you think that this misconception is still around?
Well, I think because, you know, things run out, and there's always that specter of not enough food or not enough resources for one thing or another. That's happened in the past. And it certainly could happen again. But to lay that at the feet of population, I don't think is necessarily accurate or fair. I mean, I think that's basically. I don't want to just say that they don't like children, although I think there's some truth to that.
We live in a culture that doesn't really
value children.
Well, it doesn't value children, but it idolizes them.
That's right.
There's a difference.
There is a difference. Back, 100 years ago, you had to have children in order to survive, because they were going to work the farm, they were going to take care of you, or help ease that burden when you got into an old age. And now it's more like pets. You want children to go to the soccer game and to have the best grades. And
yeah, children have become a commodity. I mean,
yes.
Now you can actually order designer babies where they will,
yes.
they will go in and sort out the genes so that babies with certain hair colors, certain eye colors, I mean, it's eugenics all over again in a way, children have become a commodity and they have to look a certain way, they have to act a certain way.
The Bible says that children are a heritage, and I don't think that's a different word than being proud of your children. I think that's, I'm not prepared to kind of talk about the history of the word heritage, but to me it carries a lot more than just, putting a bumper sticker on the back of the car that says, my kid
is an honor student.
My kid can beat your kid up, as an honor student. Yeah. And so heritage is much more important than that. And it's much deeper because it carries on generation to generation.
Yeah. It's in a real sense, if you don't count the metaphysical, then children are your representative in the world after you were gone. If you want your civilization to carry on, then you better have a lot of babies. And right now, it looks like we're going to have some successes in the upcoming elections, or at least Republicans will, because they keep on having the most babies.
Well, and I'm not going to write a best-selling novel. I'm not going to be president of the United States, although there are those that say I should be.
I'd like to meet them.
But my legacy will not go any further than one generation. When you're an old lady, you're going to remember me
pretty well. That's not true. There will be kids all over the world that listen to our podcast
I forgot. So there'll be, but you'll remember me, and you may tell your children, even your grandchildren, about me some, and that's it. They may even, you know, they're going to have some, maybe a little video or some photographs of me, and that'll be it.
But you know, just looking at our family, if you go back several generations, you've got, you can kind of trace the family mentality based on different people. You know, you have my great-great-great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather, Emery, who was a very, very level-headed, very godly man, you know, went to church every Sunday, that sort of thing, except that one time he got kicked out for hunting on a Sunday. And then you have Kilby, who was his son, and who just kind of, you can still see the effects of that legacy, even if it's not necessarily attached to his name. The sort of things that you do that affect your family really do have an effect.
A huge effect.
A huge effect.
And they affect other, you know, other people around them and their children. It's a big deal.
Yeah, and if you look at the world right now, the United States is at 1.88 births per woman as of 2012. So that means that we are below replacement rate. United Kingdom is a little bit higher at 1.9. Japan is at 1.4. Niger is at 7.58. Now,
but there are not nearly as many Nigerians.
It's true, but I highly suspect that the infant mortality rate is very high. But if you look at the Islamic world, you're going to have a really high rate of birth there, too. So, as we're looking kind of into the next century, the world is going to look much, much more Islamic, at the very least.
And I know in China that there's like 300 million more boys, males, than females in the upcoming generation.
Well, it's demographic suicide. There's never been a situation like this, really.
Right. It's very unusual and it's very scary.
And they're starting to kind of scale back the one-child policy, but it's too late.
Yeah. And you're going to have, you know, not millions, but I guess potentially billions of people who have no one to care for in their old age.
Yeah, that's what Japan's looking at right now. Is just because the bad thing about this is that when you have a population of elderly, then it's like a triangle. You have a very small amount of workers that can keep a welfare state going. And especially in like Europe, which is pretty much, you know, borderline socialism anymore, then the only reason that the European welfare state has kept going as long as it has is because of immigration. Mostly Arabic is immigration from the Middle East.
And that's probably going to be somewhat of the saving grace for the United States, the Hispanic population coming in and kind of replenishing. And that's great. I mean, I'm all for immigration. But at the same time, as they get integrated in the United States and pick up, you know,
our culture is
the contraception and the abortion and the whole idea that fewer is better, then it's...
At some point, they're going to start thinking, okay, maybe we need to stay where we are.
Yeah.
Because they can't keep us going forever. And we live in a culture of death that considers relationships to be not about children as much, you know, especially pretty much everybody except Catholics.
Here's a little test you can do with your friends. You can ask any of your friends to list name 10 of their friends, okay, on a sheet of paper, and then, you know, male or female, doesn't matter, and then out from or age, anybody over, say, 25 years old, and then have them list out how many children they have. And I would almost guarantee you that number is going to be less than the replacement rate, which would be 20. I mean, if you write 10 people's names down, then you need 20 individuals.
Wait a minute. If you write 10 couples' names down, for each adult must be replaced.
Right.
Therefore, you must have 20 adults.
That's right.
So 10 couples.
Right.
Okay. We got our math straight now. If you are interested in more on that, I recommend America Alone by Mark Steyn, which is pretty much where we're getting all our ideas. But to get back to the film, all of this is going to have a bearing. I wanted to talk a little bit about the way that in this world that is created by director Alfonso Cuarón, how do people react to this problem? What are their responses? How do they deal with it as a culture? What's the impact, or what's the perceived impact in the film of this cataclysmic event?
With no kids?
Yeah.
Depression, right? I mean, it seems like everybody's lost hope, but what's confusing about the movie, and it just doesn't seem to work for me, is that the whole immigration thing, which maybe you're going to get into.
I'm in a minute.
But yeah, between that and the no children, it's just one of complete depression or
despair.
Despair. Yeah, that's a better word.
Yeah. One of the things I disliked about the movie, and I was intending to get to this later, is the way it portrays euthanasia as something kind of quiet and, you know, peaceful and zen, you know, all that Eastern Buddhism type stuff. But which is a dramatic departure from the book, because the book unequivocally condemned euthanasia as being a system which forced the elderly to see themselves as kind of useless lives, to feel unwanted, and that people are paying for them to exist, and that you know, it would be better for them just to end it all. And it was actually a very violent, very frightening thing in the book. In this, it's glamorized and kind of, and it really dilutes what could have been a much more pro-life message, which is disappointing. But it's also unfair. But yeah, the entire everybody in this movie at the beginning, they've just kind of they don't know what the point is anymore. They're trying to kind of hide behind luxury, or they're trying to hide behind trying not to think about it. That's really the way that they're trying to deal with it.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
Or at least that's the way that ordinary British subjects tend to do. Now, Cuarón invented another subplot and kind of restructured the entire story around illegal immigration and racism and that sort of thing. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because basically the idea is that Britain has shut itself off and sees itself as the last hope for humanity and isn't letting any immigrants in at all, I don't think. For mysterious reasons, probably
yeah.
Because they're evil Tories, which is also very unfair to P.D. James, because she was a conservative peeress in the House of Lords, and it doesn't make sense. And it turns out she was right, because Europe is now basically at this state of a welfare state with the elderly dying off and not many young people. And it's being propped up by immigration. They're encouraging immigration. So it turns out he was wrong about that.
Well, and the whole thing doesn't make any sense. If you've got, you know, one generation left and that you will have no children after that, why would you want to start a war? You know, I mean, to do what? To, you know, because wars usually are all about power, and the power is only going to last, you know, it's not going to last in that scenario.
Yeah, I think the idea is that the government has whipped up enough hysteria about terrorism that they can put up these death camps and that sort of thing. And remember, this was made during the Bush era. This was early in the war in Iraq, I believe. You'll notice that Jasper, who's played by Michael Caine, who's imitating John Lennon, really, he is. It's something to see. He is kind of painted as this free spirit, marijuana smoking guy who protested the war in Iraq, and he, you know, and of course he's a hero. So, and that's kind of the ideal that the movie sets up as your hero for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, the government is, you know, what I wanted in this thing is like 2 minutes of dialogue where somebody sits down across the table and says, here's what's going on. Here are these guys, and here's why they're bad. Here's these guys, and here's why they're bad. And here's, you know.
Yeah, it had a bunch of plot holes when it came to that. Because the government was supposedly bad because they were evil police state people. And you could see they were bad. They were abusing immigrants and keeping them in cages and that sort of thing. Very unsubtle allegory, political points from Cuarón. And on the other hand, you had the Fishes, who are this terrorist group, who presumably want power for the people or whatever these rebels are always supposed to want, you know. And then it turns out they're bad because they killed Julian. And they killed her. Why? I don't know why. But...
Because Luke wanted the power.
Because Luke wanted the power. Luke Skywalker.
No.
He's not Luke Skywalker. He's Chiwetel Ejiofor. I have no idea if I pronounced that right. He's a great actor. And so they're trying to seize power. They're kind of like the IRA, I guess. Something like that.
Yeah, it's just a mishmash.
Then they're and Key and Theo and Miriam are trying to get to the Human Project outside of the country because they're... Who are they? We don't know who they are.
Right, we don't know who they are.
That wasn't in the book either. Basically, that entire plot, I mean, the entire plot of this movie, it's just nothing like the book at all. So none of that really makes sense. And it's, the Fishes, I can't even decide whether it was even supposed to.
Right, they're wanting to use Key, who's going to have the baby, she's the pregnant lady. They're wanting to use her for political gain. They don't want the government to have her because they figure the government will use her for political gain. And I'm just sitting there thinking, how do they do that?
I mean, why is the Human Project not going to use it for political gain? I mean, it's not like people aren't going to notice.
Because the big deal would be, on either side, was how can she do that? How can she have the baby when no one else can? It seems to me like that Key would have been the real Key.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that she would have been the real value because they would have wanted to know how she managed to get pregnant where others didn't.
Yeah, and that was an important point because in the book it was men that were sterile. In the movie, it's women, so she kind of becomes the person of value, all of that is kind of muddy, and you don't really find out where it is. But I would say this, that it is from a suspense point of view, if you kind of buy into it, and it obviously everybody in the movie believes they're there. It's a very fully realized reality.
Yeah. I mean, I don't watch a lot of those kind of movies where it's the end of the world and have a nice day. But
this is a fairly unique one. It's nowhere near as unique as what James painted. What she did was, in her book, she had a middle-aged civilization of people who really don't care what happens as long as nobody bothers them, as long as they can stay at home and get their coffee in the morning and then die quietly at the end of their life.
Like the United States.
Exactly. You know, and it's much more realistic. And there's a dictator who basically managed to get elected by promising people safety and, you know, and in this, it's a police state. In that, it's kind of a benevolent dictatorship from a guy who can do anything he wants because he promises people safety. And that's way more realistic, it's way more interesting, it's much more unique. But this movie kind of tends to prove its own point in that it's much more conventional, much more youth-obsessed. All the characters are younger than the characters in the book.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, because Theo in the book was an aging Oxford Don.
Hmm.
Seriously. who...
Well, had it been 18 years since the last baby was born?
Yeah, it was something like that. Okay. And but it was a much more leisurely book. I mean, this was coming from P.D. James, who is not the world's best action movie writer. It was a very, very stately pace.
It's a great idea. It's a great premise for a book or a movie.
And and I wanted to talk about Theo a little bit as kind of a hero figure. There are two very different ideas of him. Of course, in the book, he is someone who, and this is true in both of them. Many years ago, his child died. In the movie, it was from the flu. In the book, it was something else, and he's kind of lost all hope. In the book, he says, "I am 50 years old, and I have never known what it is to love. I can write those words, know them to be true, but feel only the regret that a tone-deaf man must feel because he can't appreciate music, a regret less keen because it is for something never known, not for something lost." Which is just a tremendously hopeless statement. But it's and that kind of defines his character. The character arc in the book is of him growing from someone who is despairing and doesn't care and doesn't want to get involved into someone who has to get involved, someone who, along with the pregnant woman, in the book it's Julian, must sacrifice and place his life on the line in order to accomplish something, in order to become a full human being. And how do you think that's reflected in the movie? Do you think there's some of that there?
Well, I mean, you know, again, there's just kind of these plot holes, and I don't think their whole premise of the power struggle works, because he's a civil servant in the movie, right?
Yeah, he works for some ministry.
Right, so he is a government guy. So why wouldn't he want to have Key turned over to the government? It's never made really clear. And like, I don't know. I couldn't get past some of those things in order to.
Yeah. It's
But you know, I guess he's buying into this. And he says it in the movie two or three times. He knows nothing about this human project that he's this dreamland that they want to.
Well, the way they justify his involvement is that he gets involved because of Julian, because he wants to be around her. She talks him into it, and from that point onward, he actually gets involved, and he can't get out of it. There's nothing he can do after that point. He also says. That, you know, basically he's not really interested in putting his life on the line. I don't care. I'm not interested. But by the end of it, he is doing that. And he literally does put his life on the line, and becomes a hero, becomes somebody who is going to, he kind of becomes a father figure in many ways.
Yes. Well, he's kind of the Joseph in a way.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that a little bit, kind of the echoes there of part of the nativity story. And just because I love P.D. James' writing so much, I'm going to read another quote from it about Theo. And he says, he's talking about this situation, and this just completely summarizes not only his view, but the view of British society at this point in the story. And he says, "On the whole, I'm glad. You can't mourn for unborn grandchildren when there never was a hope of them. The planet is doomed anyway. Eventually the sun will explode or cool, and one small, insignificant particle of the universe will disappear with only a tremble. If man is doomed to perish, then universal infertility is as painless a way as any, and there are, after all, personal compensations. For the last 60 years we have sycophantically pandered to the most ignorant, the most criminal, and the most selfish section of society. Now for the rest of our lives we're going to be spared the intrusive barbarism of the young, their noise, their pounding, repetitive, computer-produced, so-called music, their violence, their egotism disguised as idealism. My God, we might even succeed in getting rid of Christmas. that annual celebration of parental guilt and juvenile greed, I intend that my life shall be comfortable, and when it no longer is, then I shall wash down my final pill with a bottle of claret.
Have a nice day.
Happy holidays.
Put that on a Christmas card.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, that's, and I think in both, it does a good job of capturing his, kind of his redemption.
The movie does, or the...
Well, both of them, but I think the movie does that fairly well as well.
Yeah. I mean, I like Theo. He's a character that you like, because he seems to be the only one that's kind of got any sort of moral standard, you know, and he doesn't even know where that comes from.
Yeah, well, he's somebody who's just, Clive Owen is putting so much of himself into the part. He is really thinking he's right there. He works really well as an action hero because, like Harrison Ford, as you mentioned the other day, you can see him thinking, trying to puzzle out what he's going to do. He is somebody who's always going to be trying for something else. He's very different from a lot of action heroes in that he doesn't think with his fists. He's not somebody who's going to. He never uses a gun in the movie, as far as I remember. He's somebody that has to get by on ingenuity and just sheer grit.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good point. There's lots of guns around him.
Yeah, everybody else uses guns. Speaking of that, I think that just the world building in this film is spectacular. It does a really good job of building this, a very brutal place to live, but it feels really convincing. You feel like it's some place that actually existed. It's a lot of people have kind of described it as like being inside a documentary about the future, especially given all of the long takes that the cinematographer uses, in which this movie is sort of famous for. Emmanuel Lubezki, I think, he's also well known for The New World and for Gravity and for The Tree of Life. He's a wonderful cinematographer. But it has some really, really amazing shots.
Sure does. Yep. No doubt about it. I mean, and I think they did an extraordinary good job of creating a future world. A lot of times, when you see a movie like that, it just doesn't feel right for some reason or another. And they go overboard in trying to put too much of the gee whiz.
Sci-fi stuff
into the future worlds, and
I mean, this doesn't have any sci-fi stuff really.
It has rickshaws
and old buses and
yeah, I mean it
coffee.
It seemed like, now I will say that this at the same time is, I don't think he used a cell phone hardly in the thing, did he?
This was 2005 or
yeah,
6,
I mean,
so
there was some basic technologies that we have now, GPS, cell phones. Even portable computers like a iPad or whatever, that you didn't see hardly any of that in the movie, and I thought, well, that's not exactly realistic either.
Yeah, a lot of it anymore.
A little bit of it.
Everybody has an iPhone. I don't know if you did then. I don't know. It's been so long for me. It's also yeah. I mean, it's also just this entire world. It's a very gritty, very dark reality.
Brutal.
Very brutal.
I mean, for the whole thing to be kind of propping up the importance of life and new life, there sure as heck is taking a lot of life in the process, you know, in the movie. People gunning down left and right. It's a very hard movie to watch in that regard.
Yeah, do you think it's too much? I mean, do you think it goes over the top, or...?
I think it goes over the top. Depending on what the heck the message is supposed to be. Again, I guess what he's trying to drive home is that, you know, life is very precious, new life is miraculous, and yet we so often, through any number of ways, particularly I think his message is through war, just completely use life as a fodder, you know. On either side, you know, on any side of a given war, his position is probably going to be, it's not worth it. The
the cost, the human toll, is not worth the sacrifice. And that's simply not true. It's just simply not true. I mean, there's very strong forces of good. I mean, to lay down your life for...
Yeah, this guy, I mean, it's obviously well, if P.D. James's was a much more conservative and Christian allegory, Quarone's is a much more spiritually ambiguous and blatantly liberal allegory, in that he doesn't really have a concept of any sort of just war theory. He's not going to go into that. He invents a John Lennon character for the movie. And and in this movie, the John Lennon character gets a tragic and heroic death. In the book, he's found half-rotted away after taking a suicide drug by Theo, and it's a very shocking moment. I think that's true. I don't remember, but it's a much more despairing moment. I think it probably does go over the top at times.
I think so. It's just.
They would have done well if they had cut back on a little bit of the violence in the last 30 minutes and spent some time talking about some of the implications of things. This is basically a thoughtful action movie. I wish it had been a little bit more thoughtful than it was, because the book was a thoughtful book.
Well, it wasn't really an action book. Figure out for yourself. You know, kind of.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, they do have times when they're sitting there talking about, you know, fate and all that sort of stuff. It's much more thoughtful than, say, I don't know, like Terminator. It's just kind of the first thing that comes up.
I mean, guess that the moment, obviously, where the baby's born, and hey, we're the spoilers here. We tried to tell you.
We've already spoiled everything anyway.
The baby's born, and you know, everybody stops fighting for at least a minute and a half. And that's kind of a cool moment, but I don't know. Do you think they played that well?
I thought that was really, really well done. But again, Quarone isn't interested in giving you any answers. He has all these questions, and it's ambiguous, and but he never really gives you any sorts of answers about hope. He shows you all sorts of examples of despair, and he shows you some examples of hope, but he doesn't tell you what hope is, what hope should be in. And he did that on purpose. I don't think he's a Christian. He said that instead of God, we needed to have hope in the next generation. And, you know...
That's what he said?
Yeah, that's what he said. Which, you know, I'm sure P.D. James would have loved to have heard that, because in the book, that's...
that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's not ridiculous in that...
The next generation is important. But
the next generation is important, and there's a layer of truth there to that. But if that generation doesn't learn the lessons of the previous ones, and doesn't hold those truths to be precious, then you know, then go to Walmart and get in line with the gal who's got the 3-year-old in front of you that is just having a complete meltdown, and you just, you know, there's no discipline at all, and there's no, you know, that's the future that you're going to be looking at.
Yeah.
That's kind of ridiculous, an allegory, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, Chesterton used to say that I have long ceased to argue with people who prefer Thursday to Wednesday because it is Thursday, and he was kind of making a jab at progressives there, which is just, you know, let's go forward and tomorrow, you know, the name of the ship that rescues Key supposedly rescues her at the end of the movie is The Tomorrow, which is probably something he has a lot more hope in than we do. Just because it's tomorrow doesn't mean it's going to be better.
It's true.
Yeah, the ending of the film, do you find it hopeful or despairing? I mean, he meant it to be ambiguous. He said that he wanted it to reflect, you know, he said he wanted you to kind of figure that out for yourself.
No, I think if he achieved that, because...
He said it's either, if you're a bleak person, it'll be very bleak. If you're a hopeful person, you'll find your own hope in it.
It was just kind of... Again, I don't know who... It could have been that the people on the Tomorrow boat were just as bad as the people she left.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the point he wanted to make.
Or they could have been as good as, you know, terrific folks. But you just don't know. And so it's sad from that standpoint. It's a very, I don't know, I don't think I ever want to watch it again. Because it's just, there was so much violence and so much disregard for life. And to try to say that this life, because it's young, is special, is just just tragic.
Yeah, I mean, but it was important that Theo never kills anyone.
No.
I mean, the fishes kill someone. They kill the policeman, and they end up being the bad guy.
It's important to, but
I don't think that it's trying to paint disregard for life as something that's good. But
Theo doesn't have any reason to be good. Does he?
No, it doesn't seem to be.
Right. So why would he be? Well, you know, I just don't know. I think that just when men, when left their own devices, are sinful and depraved. Lord of the Flies, you know. That's really what it's about. In a way, and that's the world that is being set up here, and then we're expected to believe that one guy is going to do the right thing just because he looks great and he's, I don't know, got some higher sense of honor.
Well,
why should he?
I mean,
it doesn't answer that question for me, and that's a question he completely just wants me to, you know, he just wants me to believe that there's a good guy out there. Just as equally as he wants me to believe there's a bunch of bad guys out there.
But it is true that there have been lots of guys in the world that have done great and extraordinary and heroic things, even when they don't have any sort of connection to a spiritual reality or something.
I don't think
they're saving things, but I think people have done good things.
What I'm saying is I've got an answer to that.
Okay,
He doesn't.
Yeah, in the book, was an answer.
If you're gonna, okay, Mr. Director, what's his name?
Quaron.
If you're gonna tell me that there are really bad guys out there and then there's some good ones, you gotta tell me why that is. I don't think that's... And that's something he would say. I think it's something he would really struggle with answering.
I think that he would probably say, and I think the movie tries to get to this, but it doesn't examine it as fully as I would like to have, is that he ends up doing what is right and protecting Key because of love. Because he is acting in a loving and sacrificial way. And that kind of draws us.
Well, he would probably say because of this, some hocus pocus thing about the memory of his son. You know, he was honoring the memory of his son and the love that he had for his ex-wife, and you know, et cetera, you know, and what could have been, and all that kind of soft stuff. But that just doesn't get it for me. I'm sorry.
I mean, I think you have a point, but I think that. There is some legitimacy to acting from love. I mean, what greater love has no man than this, you know? And he ends up becoming sort of a a Christ figure in that he is willing to sacrifice himself and to do those things to love. And in the book has quite strong parallels to another book called Brideshead Revisited. Even overtly, she references that in the text, which has another character who starts out as someone who just doesn't care, someone who is in particular very atheistic, and who learns to love and who finds his humanity through doing that, who commits these small sacrificial acts of grace and kindness. And that these acts, and he doesn't particularly know where they come from. In the book, it goes farther towards explaining that. But
I just don't like that. I just think it's a cop. Is it? I just don't. You know, the whole idea of it doesn't fit the atheist model to me for people to do sacrificial service. What's the point? Why would I possibly want to do that? To better mankind? Who cares? I mean, what's the point?
Yeah. You're right. It's
to make it better for the next generation. Who cares about them either? I mean, this is, you know, it doesn't matter if they live or die.
But at the same time, atheists love their children, and atheists.
What? Based on what?
Well, it's illogical, but it happens. So I don't think we can.
They're going to say, well, you know, we're just wired to take care of our offspring or whatever, you know. Then. I just don't get it. I don't understand that. But at any rate, there you have it.
Well, I mean, if you're going to logically explain everything every character does in every movie, you're
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that he's asking me to.
I wish he had. I will just end with this. I wish he had examined that. I wish he had thought about it more. I don't think that it's an illogical story, and I think that. In a way it's an archetype. It's kind of an echo of a story that does make sense. And I wanted to talk about that. Is that from a spiritual point of view, it echoes the nativity story quite strongly, because of a child that represents hope. And this child, in the movie, this child represents hope for the human race because we will keep on reproducing and so on. But at the same time, the director can't quite get away from the idea that this child represents a more spiritual hope. That because when they're walking through the war zone and the ceasefire has started, there are those guys who are crossing themselves. There's a lot of Christian symbolism in it. Theo and Key, in many ways, as refugees fleeing from an oppressive government, kind of represent Joseph and Mary. I don't think that, the ceasefire only lasts for about 2 minutes, which is very sad, but right after that they go back to killing each other. So again, he can't quite decide, okay, this child isn't going to solve our problems, but at the same time, he's kind of wishing that there were some sort of hope that could be born into the world that would represent that, And that's another reason I wanted to start with this movie, is because we're coming up on the Christmas season, so, it's possibly the most depressing Christmas movie you'll ever watch.
I think that's an understatement.
What did you think about the kind of the Christian echoes, symbolism and that sort of thing in the movie?
I guess there some of them were there. I just struggled to see, I guess, some of that because of the brutality, the overall brutality of the movie, and the lack of any kind of moral basis. I mean, when some people decide to do good, it's just like, it's all almost on a whim, and they want to get this girl to a safer place, but I don't know why. And I didn't pick up many Christian overtones too. I guess they're there, but I didn't see them.
Okay. Well, I think we're probably about ready to wrap it up. Ratings?
Oh, I don't know. It's really well done for what it is. It is very suspenseful, or you know, a lot of action. You mentioned the cinematography, which is great. The acting's very good.
Yeah, I mean, I really cared about the characters.
Right, the casting's pretty good, I thought. Well, no, maybe not so much. On some of the main characters, I liked Theo very much, but the main character.
What about Key?
Oh, she did well. But that's about it.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought Luke was pretty good.
I thought he was pretty good, but he wasn't in a lot of scenes.
He didn't. Yeah, he wasn't. Miriam
was. That was just ridiculous.
She did. She was cast to be a midwife. She wasn't cast to be a Buddhist priestess.
And
I think.
And Julianne Moore is just too pretty to be a revolutionary and that kind of a thing. I mean, it's just.
I thought it was a really interesting choice to kill her off so soon.
Well, yeah, but still, she looked like a model. It was hard to believe that.
Yeah.
So. I don't know. I'm going to give it a 2 or 2.5. Probably 2.
So?
Out of 5.
If 2.5 is neutral, then this movie goes over into the bad movie side
of
things?
It does.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, wow. I would give it a more positive review. I've seen it twice now. The first time I was really disappointed because it is nowhere near as good as the book. I highly recommend that you read it. But the second time I enjoyed it more, despite the...
Did Miss James use as many four-letter words as they use in this movie?
No. Though it's interesting because Mark Stein, in his review of it, he was not at all a fan. He really complained about the excessive amount of language because he knew that she had complained to him before about James Bond. She said that she liked, I think, Timothy Dalton the best because... He had the least amount of gratuitous sex and cursing, so he said she would hate this movie because of all the cursing. And it turns out that she didn't actually hate it all that much. She said she was proud to be associated with it, though I don't know what that necessarily means. But no, she didn't use anywhere near as much language.
So what are you going to give it?
For me, it's going to be probably a 3 or 3.5. It has a lot of issues. But I enjoyed it. It's so well done. It works really well, even on a second viewing, as a suspenseful thing, and it just building the world. But it's got so many illogical plot points. It's trying so hard to push its political agenda.
Yeah.
That it's beating you over the head with that. The spiritual aspect of it is kind of on the nose. It's not very subtle. When he sees the baby, you know, he uses the name of Jesus as kind of as a curse word. But they use it twice when people see the baby. So it's just like, oh, this is supposed to be symbolic. So that's pretty obvious. But at the same time, I think that kind of as a spiritual parable, just bringing out those archetypes of a mother... And a man who, in the end, gives his life to save them. I think it's very emotionally effective on a emotional and sensory appeal. It does a really good job of appealing to the senses.
Oh, you buy in.
Sound.
I mean, I will say this. I bought into it.
Which is something I don't do in many movies. A lot of the times you're able to sit back and kind of critique it. And we had time to do that because we paused the movie and got popcorn and stuff. You sat and said, wait a minute. This illegal immigration thing, that doesn't make sense. But at the same time, you really bought into it. So I would give it probably a 3.5. Which is a good movie, but it's not a great movie. It could have been much better. But at the same time, I still find it moving. I still find it effective. So, all right. So what are we doing next week?
I don't know.
Yeah, I guess you do. I told you earlier. We're going to do a Christmas Carol.
Oh, that's right.
We're going to watch. There are two different versions of A Christmas Carol that we're going to contrast and compare. I'm going to try and read the book again over the week if I can get around to it. We're going to talk about that. And as Christmas is coming up, we're hoping to watch several Christmas movies. You can find, we're going to talk about the 1984 version, which was, I think, a TV movie with George C. Scott, who was born just over the hill.
In Wise County,
West Virginia, or Virginia?
Virginia.
So, yeah, he's one of our countrymen. And we're also going to talk about the 1950 version, I think it's 50, Alistair Sim, which is black and white. You can find both of those on YouTube, and I encourage you to check them out. They're both quite good, and that's what we'll be talking about next week.
Delightful.
Yes, something much more uplifting. In the meantime, let us know what you have to think about this episode at our blog, or email us at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. We'll read your comments on the air. You can also follow us on Twitter, Longish and Grovoy, or on Facebook. And we blog individually at Longish and What's He That Wishes So. In the meantime, perhaps we should return to P.D. James. As she says in the book, the world is changed, not by the self-regarding, but by men and women prepared to make fools of themselves. Or, as the professor says,
that principle runs all through life from the top to the bottom. Give up yourself and you will find your real self. Lose your life and you will save it. Submit to death, submit with every fiber of your being, and you will find eternal life. Look for Christ and you will get him, and with him everything else thrown in. Look for yourself and you will get only hatred, loneliness, despair.